gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to all of you out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with NPR Illinois. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and this is our June edition of Front Row Classics. I was telling Eric, it feels like we're in a parallel universe that we're in June already, but here we are. And I have joining with me this month, as I mentioned, my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
Oh, Brandon, it's going better than I deserve. So it's going really well.
Yep. And then also joining us this month is Allison Means. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Brandon. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hello, listeners.
You know, we're in such a unique period of history right now, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what's coming next, you know, what we're all here for. But you know what? Throughout history, there have been other rough periods, but the movies have always been there to comfort us, to calm us, to comment on what's going on. And right now, this month, we're talking about, I think, one of the great escapist movies of all time, especially was released at a time when the world needed it. And that's The Adventures of Robin Hood from 1938. Just about as fun and adventurous and colorful as a movie can get. First time we talked about Errol Flynn here on Classics, and we're a few years in. It's hard to believe. But
yeah, that is really surprising.
But yeah, so this is, if you're going to start with one, though, this is the one to start with. So we'll start with you, Allison, though. What are your first impressions of The Adventures of Robin Hood?
So this was actually the first time I'd watched it completely through.
Oh, wow.
I had seen, I was as surprised as you are. I'm like, oh, wait, I don't think I've ever actually watched this in its entirety. It was delightful. I had to keep pausing it because my two-year-old kept needing apple juice, but even with interruptions, just delightful.
Yeah. Yeah. Eric, when was the first time you saw Robin Hood?
Oh boy, young. This was, you know, this takes me back to a time at my grandparents' house where this would have been on, you know, maybe the Saturday matinee on the television or something like that. I appreciated it as a 7, 8, 9 year old kid then. It's still like watching it today. I mean, it's not built for kids, even though you could certainly have your kids enjoy this movie with you. It does everything well. So yeah. I really enjoyed this watch through of it.
Yeah. And the thing that got me this time, and I've noticed it before, but it doesn't feel dated whatsoever. It's like, as I, you know, it doesn't feel like 1938. I mean, it feels, I guess, because so many other Robin Hoods have copied it, and because there's nothing 1938 about it. It's already a period piece, and there's so much action and it moves so fast. It feels modern, and that's really, really interesting as I watched it this time.
Yeah, and I think that when you say that other things copied it, it sort of set the standard, and everything that's come after has had their own sort of take on it, whether it's the, you know, the 1970s Disney cartoon or the 1990s Costner film or the one that Russell Crowe did not so many years ago. They've all either been goofier or darker or more technology or adding a character here and there. But this one is sort of the gold standard, and you really can't hold a candle to it. It really does everything so well that all those other ones are sort of pale imitations of it.
definitely. Yeah. This one, you said the gold standard. Absolutely. And when you conjure up an image, you know, in your mind of Robin Hood, whether you've actually seen this film or not, it's probably Errol Flynn or a cartoon fox.
Yeah, that's what I think the first version of Robin Hood I saw was the Disney version, like many do. Yeah. And it's interesting to me, this is a little more, I think, aligned with the legend of Robin Hood, because you always think of Little John as Robin Hood's sidekick, but in this movie it's Will Scarlet.
Will Scarlet.
Which follows the legend. I mean, Little John is still a big part of it, but yeah, so interesting with so many different facets. And I think what also just got me too was this was made in 1938, and we always sort of think is the 1939 with the two big Technicolor movies of Oz and Gone with the Wind, and this was a year before that. And, you know, color wasn't new by any means at the time, but, you know, I think this was the first time where audiences really saw what Technicolor could do and how, you know, it could definitely transport you to another world. Even though they shot it, you know, the forests of California, you feel like you're in 12th century England.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so let's just move on to talking about some of the cast here. We'll start with Errol Flynn as Robin Hood. And as I mentioned before, first time we've talked about Errol Flynn, but this is really sort of, if you talk about typecasting, this is really sort of Errol Flynn's vein here. This is sort of his, this is sort of where he's stuck. I don't think he veered too far from it, from his career. You know, he came on the scene with Captain Blood a few years earlier and just stayed a swashbuckler for the rest of his career. And I think he's underrated. I don't think we talk about Errol Flynn like we do in the same vein of other major actors at the time. And there's just a, there's an ease and a charm about him. Maybe he makes it look too easy, but I think he fits this role perfectly. Like maybe he didn't fit any other role, Allison.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like you said, he might even make it look too easy.
Yeah.
All the swordplay and you know, the repartee between characters, it's just very natural throughout the whole film. And some of it is really challenging stuff. Mm-hmm. Particularly, you know, when you get into the fight choreography and things. And yeah, he makes it look like no big deal, which is so completely of Loxley. Like, he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to fight this guy. Cool. Whatever. He'll knock me into the water. Whatever. Yeah. Come on. Like, I know it's a trap. I'm going to go anyway. Yeah. Like a perfect casting, a perfect job. Like I don't have anything bad to say.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a jovialness to everything he does. It's like even when he's in the in the greatest danger, it's like, oh, it's okay, I'll get through it somehow.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I've got some more crimes for you to put on here for you. I forgot about this one and this one.
Yeah, yeah, Eric, what are your thoughts on Flynn?
He does a great job in this film, and certainly an actor that was typecast throughout his career. Uh-huh. And there was a reason for it. It's because he's great at what he needed to do here. He can do all the athletic things that Allison mentioned and make it look easy as he's doing it. And I don't know what the stuntman situation was in 1938, but there are shots that you can see that it's Errol Flynn climbing 15 feet up into the air, you know, on some sort of set that they built. So he does all of that with ease. I mean, this is a guy, we never got to see him get that more challenging role. This film is the product of the studio system, you know, where they were putting together the formula and they just kept plugging him in to those lead roles in these adventure type films, because he could handle it. He could do it. It would have been great to kind of see what else he could have done with a role with a little more depth, a little more nuance, a little more meat on the bones. That being said, he's fun to watch. Every scene that he's in, he's a movie star. I mean, he's a full-fledged movie star.
He's so charming. Every time he opens his mouth, every time the camera is on him, you're just drawn to whether he is the focus of the scene or not. If you watch him, even when he's, you know, kind of in the background of things, he's so charismatic on film. You don't want to watch anyone else.
Yeah. And another one of my favorites of his that was made a couple of years after this is called The Seahawk. And it's kind of a Mutiny on the Bounty-ish type movie, but it's same thing. And there's just something about him that just really, really grabs you and takes you to a different place. You almost don't feel like he's a product of the 30s. You feel like he's a product of a century before. Yeah. He's just got that. He's got that charisma about him. And I some of the things I've read, you know, and Errol Flynn didn't have the greatest life. You know, he lived hard. He played hard. Olivia, I read an interview with Olivia de Havilland, who we'll talk about here soon, but she said that part of the reason, she said he was always a little depressed because even a movie like Robin Hood was never considered to be prestigious by Warner Brothers. They were always kind of thought to be, just money makers or whatever. And she said that always broke his heart. And so she said, I think it was late 40s, early 50s, I forget, but they had just released Robin Hood back into the theaters, and Olivia de Havilland said, well, I'm going to go and see it. I haven't seen it since it came out. And she said she just couldn't believe how fresh and alive and everything still was and how good he was. And she said she wanted to go home and write him a letter just to tell him, you know, how good it was and how wonderful the audience did. And she stopped herself because she said, no, he'll just think I'm silly or whatever. And a month later he died. So she said she just said she regretted never sending that letter because she said she never really thought in his lifetime he knew how loved and how great he was.
That's so sad.
But I mean, he certainly gives us great joy on the screen still. But you know, what's interesting to me is, like as you said, Eric, it's a lot of the physicality that he does, how he's always game for it. You know, he's in the finale, he's dueling against Basil Rathbone, who in real life was a master swordsman, and Errol Flynn is keeping up with him step for step.
Yeah, and some of the research I did for this, they train extensively, and they wanted to do the fight choreography that would sort of be structured like a dance, where there would be steps. And apparently Errol Flynn got into some of the fight scenes and just decided he didn't need to remember the choreography and just allowed his natural athletic ability to take over, and still matched Basil Rathbone, who is this amazingly trained fencer, step for step. So the guy just had an insane natural athletic ability that allowed him to do stuff like that.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah.
My understanding is he really didn't have any like training before this in fencing at all.
No, and an interesting tidbit about Errol Flynn, he might be the only major celebrity in history that was born in Tasmania. So an Australian actor, you know, which around that time, certainly there wasn't many, but yeah, just thrust it, you know, that they thrust him into Captain Blood, which was this swashbuckling pirate adventure, you know, and he just kind of got stuck with that and had to sort of learn as he went. But, you know, you did what you had to do.
Yeah.
Right.
So let's move on to the leading lady, Olivia de Havilland, who plays a Maid Marian, who, by the way, July 1st turns 104. She's still with us, living in Paris, and by all accounts, still healthy.
Amazing. Amazing.
Incredible.
Yeah, just amazing. And what I love about her portrayal in Maid Marian. And she was a frequent leading lady of Errol Flynn and all of his. She's in, I think, 5 or 6. They became a team, and I think at one point were romantically linked in real life as well. But she's never the damsel in distress, which you would find in these kinds of movies. She's always a woman of substance. She always controls her own destiny, as Maid Marian does in this. And knowing Olivia de Havilland in life, she wouldn't settle for anything less either. And she's just... I think she's just an amazing presence, Eric.
Yeah, and I think part of that in this one is the script. And you refer to her, and I'm not sure how she's credited in the film as Maid Marian, but I noticed they never call her that. They call her the Lady Marian of Fitzwater or whatever, Fitzwalter or whatever it is. And she starts off initially as sort of a cohort of Prince John. Much more than you see in some of the other Robin Hood films, where, you know, she's a damsel in distress, or a prisoner even of Prince John. In this, she's right along with him until she has this change of heart. And I think it's well played by Olivia de Havilland. She and Errol Flynn, you can't really talk about one without the other during this time period, because they were in so many movies together. And I think this was the third one they were in. She was in Captain Blood as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they just have this chemistry on screen too, that one of the reasons that you're watching him is because how she's watching him throughout the movie as well. And she gives for as much magnetism that he's got on screen, she matches that energy and is right there step for step with Errol Flynn throughout the whole movie.
Absolutely, yeah. Alice. Yeah.
I mean, you guys know I'm a like resident feminist, so I love a well written female part, and and Olivia de Havilland. Every time she's on screen in everything she's ever done, you're so struck by. She's got the most expressive eyes. She doesn't have to be saying anything, really doing anything, but you can tell, you know, the rich internal life of these characters that she has developed just from the way she's reacting with her eyes. You can see, you know, her eyes dart around in nervous situations, like when, you know, she's trying to cover up where she's put the note and all that. When the way that she looks at Errol Flynn with this warmth, and she matches him every time, which that's tough. That's a tough job when you've got such a dynamic character, like a swashbuckler. They're always, you know, in a high action type scenario, they come climbing up into the window, or, you know, they're fighting their way through a great hall. And female characters, especially in this time period, you don't usually get a lot of physical stuff.
Yeah.
So it's all the more difficult to hold your own against a big physical presence when you don't have as much to do there. And she does it.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Our listeners, I know, can't see Allison, but as she was describing Errol Flynn, there was a lot of movement, arm movement, and, you know, the physicality. And that's exactly what he looks like on screen. And Olivia de Havilland, they covered her. You know, the really the only thing you see of her, the entire movie, is just her face. She makes it work so well.
And what I love about her as well is she's one of those actresses that always had chemistry with everybody. And so, you know, of course she and Flynn have great chemistry, but she's working with two of the biggest hams in movie history, with Claude Rains and Basil Rathbone. And she's step for step with them. And it's really amazing to watch that. But yeah, I love the whole scene where where Robin and the Merry Men have captured, you know, captured Sir Guy and Marian and all that. And they're having that, you know, barbecue and everything. And she's very, she's very dismissive of Robin in the beginning, but slowly, I love the way that she slowly lets her guard down as she suddenly discovers, wow, there is a, that there is a wonderful, there's a wonderful motive here for him, and he's really trying to help the least of those in England at the time, and how suddenly everything about her changes, because she's been icy up to that point, but then the warmth comes through and she really, it's all in her face because she can't do anything else.
What a great message, I think. And maybe we'll save this till we get to that scene. But there's a great message there that, where you see in her face that she has this revelation of maybe I wasn't right all along. And I'll leave that there, and maybe we'll touch back on that when we get to favorite scenes.
Yeah.
She plays that so well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. One thing I do want to discuss about Olivia de Havilland, and we've only discussed her one other time, and that was when Jeremy and Sarah and I discussed Gone with the Wind a couple of years ago. And as we've discussed this week, there's a lot to unpack with that movie, and so we didn't get around to really discussing Olivia in detail, but Olivia is a very important person in the history of Hollywood. She should be the patron saint of movie actors, because and we've discussed the studio system already in several other podcasts, but it was a contract system. Studios basically owned stars. They told them what movies they were going to be in. If another studio wanted you, they would loan you out like a baseball team would in exchange for somebody else. And if you refused to do a role at that time, you were suspended, and you were suspended without pay. And however long it took to make the movie that you were suspended for was added to your contract. So you could sign a contract for 7 years and be there 10 years later if you turn down enough things. Wow. So Olivia was loaned out to Selznick to do Gone with the Wind. It was a huge hit. She got nominated for an Oscar. And basically Warner's decided to punish her for being successful in another studio. And aside from the Errol Flynn movies on her own, they gave her crappy scripts. And even a great script. There was a play called The Constant Nymph, which Warner's had acquired, and instead of giving it to Olivia, who was one of their big stars at the time, they borrowed Joan Fontaine, who was her sister, and gave it to her.
Ouch.
To spite her.
Oh.
And then Olivia played Betty Davis's sidekick in other movies and things like that. And so finally, at the end of her 7 years, she was ready to leave Warner's and go somewhere else. And they said, you've got 6 more months left on your contract because you turned down a few things. So she thought this wasn't fair. And Betty Davis actually had taken Warner's to court back in the 30s, long before this, and lost the court case. Although Jack Warner ended up respecting Betty Davis and started giving her better roles. But Olivia decided to take Warner Brothers to court, much to the risk of her entire career. And she ended up winning. And then Warner Brothers appealed it, and they went to the California Supreme Court, and she won again. And it's in the law books as the de Havilland decision that nobody in Hollywood can have anything longer than a 7-year contract. So, and she also made it possible for actors being able to finally choose the roles that they wanted to do. So, yeah, I mean, I think modern Hollywood owes everything to Olivia de Havilland.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And honestly, she's probably the better of the two leads here. And when you look at the other roles as we get into them, kind of think about those actors. She's really the only one that didn't get typecast in sort of a studio system role. And was able to break free of that. So good on her.
She had a great career in the late 40s because she did things like The Snake Pit, which really delved with like mental illness. And then she would do a movie like The Heiress. And then, she was in a lot of different things once the whole court case happened, and she kind of laid low for a couple of years and then came back, and they were offering her the moon after that. So, and she ended up winning 2 Oscars later in her career. So yeah.
She a couple Oscars, I think an Emmy. Yeah. She did I think it was for an Anastasia.
I think so.
Piece that she did.
Mm-hmm.
She's so fascinating. She's so interesting. Yeah.
And then she decides to just up and retire and live in France, and which she's done quietly for years. And I think she came back one time for like the Oscars 75th anniversary or something like that in the early 2000s, but really doesn't make many public appearances and just wants to live a normal life. So
just a 104-year-old lady, yeah, doing her thing. Whatever that is.
And apparently she has, it's, I read an article, she has every intention to live to 110. So
happy 104th, Olivia.
Yeah.
We love you.
Absolutely. So every good hero, as we talked about, there's got to be great villains. And this movie cast two of the greatest actors to ever play villains. And that's Basil Rathbone and Claude Rains. Basil Rathbone was so good at being nasty.
You hate him so much. He's so great.
And the great thing about Basil Rathbone is he played these great villains, and then he made a living about a decade later playing Sherlock Holmes in all these movies. So so he could go between both. But yeah, he's an elegant villain, but you just want to smack him. He's so incredible. Yeah. Allison, any other thoughts about Rathbone?
He's just so slimy in this. It's so great. It's so perfect.
Yeah, Eric?
Yeah. So I think we talked about the fact that Basil Rathbone, it was an amazing fencer, and he gets to show that off really, really well in this film. And they've got a wig on him. They've got the facial haircut in the nasty villain way. But physically, he's Errol Flynn's match as well. So, I mean, he was certainly an athlete. But the thing that he had was that sneer, that look in his eye that he was better than everyone else. And it really plays well. You love the guy as Sherlock Holmes, and you love to hate him in a role like this. So it's a lot of fun watching him on screen in this one.
Mm-hmm. He's fabulous. And the thing is, he's a great match for Errol Flynn because they're both very handsome guys in totally different ways, but they're really on equal playing fields. They're each other's equal, but they're the light and the dark of each other. And it's really, really fun to watch. And then Claude Rains, I think, is one of the greatest chameleons in movie history because he can play Louis in Casablanca. He can play the corrupt senator in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And then he can play this. And he's just great. And the thing I love about his portrayal of Prince John is it's almost like, even though he's doing these dastardly things, it's like he's at a cocktail party.
The whole thing, it's so like, he's so flippant about everything. It's kind of silly. I love it.
Yeah. And isn't that a little like Louis in Casablanca? I mean, he's got this kind of way of being morally ambiguous. And you're just like, oh, I guess that's just how that character is. And you just go along with it. So that's a really hard feat. That's a really hard thing to do, is to be the villain. But, you know, I'd probably sit down and have dinner with that villain, you know,
that's
really a bad guy. So
yeah, as much as you have these strong, you know, strong feelings of distaste for Basil Rathbone, you're like, this guy's just kind of an idiot. Like,
yeah. But then he comes up with this amazing plan to trap Robin Hood too. So he's fooled you into thinking he's an idiot. So just a great performance here.
Because even at the end when he's lost and Richard is banishing him, it's almost like, okay.
He's like, I guess I'll leave.
You don't need to see him run through. Some villains, you want to see them get their comeuppance. And if he goes away, all right, fine, you know?
Right.
Yeah, poor guy at Gisborne, you know, gets the big bloody death. But, you know,
it feels like earned, you know? Yeah. But at the same time, if you watched, if they did the same thing to, you know, the Prince John character, you'd be like, well, okay, I guess.
Yeah, just really great. And then really, I mean, this cast is stacked with amazing character actors. And that's the one thing I can say that old Hollywood did so well that I don't think we do, because it's almost like everybody's a character actor now. But I love those, specific character actors that were used, where you might not have known their names, but you definitely knew their faces. And when they were in a movie, it just made you happy. And I guess let's just whatever one like sticks out to you, we'll just talk about. Allison, is there one in particular?
Oh gosh, the nurse.
Oh, Una O'Connor, yeah, Beth.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, she's a riot. She's so funny.
She's got one of the best speaking voices.
Oh yeah. Well, and she's got these intense eyebrows. They're very like semicircular. They're like these perfect half circles, and she uses them.
Eric, you and I in December talked to Christmas in Connecticut, and she is the maid, Barbara Stanwyck's maid.
Absolutely.
On the farm in that movie, and she plays a very similar character, but boy is she funny.
Oh, she's so funny.
Yeah, well, for good or worse, again, this is another actor through the studio system who sort of gets typecast in this servant role.
Yeah.
But she's so good at it. She's so good at being the sidekick and, you know, smirking so that it makes you smile or laugh in a scene. So the studio system definitely set out to do something and then would deliver it. They found the best people to do those things. And she's great. She's just great at playing that sidekick role.
And she has great chemistry with Much. Their banter back and forth is great. You just want these two to live happily ever after together.
Yeah, in sort of idiocy. And,
oh yeah, I mean, she's gonna nag him his whole life, but still.
For sure.
Yeah, Eric, who sticks out to you?
So when he came on screen this time, Alan Hale, mm-hmm. I looked at him and I thought, that can't be the skipper from Gilligan's Island. But I was like, boy, it sure looks like the skipper from Gilligan's Island. Well, that's because Alan Hale is Alan Hale Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, Alan Hale Jr., played the skipper on Gilligan's Island. But Alan Hale as Little John is great. He's got the big, boisterous personality that you want that character to have. And he must have been good at it because he played that role not only in the 1922 version of Robin Hood, but then further along in the 1950s, there was another Robin Hood movie that came out that he played Little John.
Yeah, three times. That's pretty impressive. Yeah, I just there's a big boisterous warmth to Alan Hale. That's so great. And he's in a lot of Errol Flynn movies too. Errol Flynn movies had a lot of the same casts and a lot of, but you didn't mind because they were all so good.
Right.
I really love Eugene Pallette as Friar Tuck. It's so not what you would think Friar Tuck would be for him to have this really raspy smoker's voice. and I love, and he's not this, you know, benevolent friar. He'll take you down.
He will fight you.
Well, and I think they mentioned that he's the best swordsman in all the Shire. And, what's he doing being a friar then, you know? He's there for some comic relief and another really well-played performance.
Yeah. And Melville Cooper is the Sheriff of Nottingham, who's the most useless.
Yeah. He's like, well, we couldn't find him.
I looked all around this 2-foot area that I'm sitting in, and I couldn't find him.
I
looked under the table. He's not there.
I love during the toward the beginning when Robin crashes the dinner party and he's sitting at the table and then all of a sudden they bring out into the sword fight and he's like, if only I could get at it. Yeah, oh man, yeah, he's so good. And then Patrick Knowles is Will Scarlet. He doesn't get a whole lot to do, but he's very likable, and he has, you know, it is interesting that, you know, like we said, I think Disney puts it in your mind that Little John is always, you know, Robin Hood's right-hand man, but Will Scarlet, it gave me an education the first time I saw it. But yeah, I think he's very likable and, you know, does what he needs to do. But I always feel like when you have Errol Flynn, you don't need kind of another good-looking.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, yeah, okay, and, also pretty. Bye.
Yeah, but not much to do in this movie. Yeah. He's just kind of there.
He just plays the background music.
He rescues Much after Much has been beaten up.
That's really about it.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, just a really great cast from top to bottom. Let's move on though, because there's a lot. You know, it's funny. Like I was talking to you about Eric last month when we talked on the waterfront, there was a lot of deep, meaty scenes to talk about. But in this movie, it's like set pieces. It's big set pieces to talk about. So, yeah, Eric, what's one of your favorite scenes in this movie?
So. When you talk about those big meaty set pieces, you know, the minute that you see Robin Hood first come on screen, there's a couple of things that happen. Immediately, you know that movies prior to this that had been shot in color, this was doing something different. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, at the time was one of the first Technicolor movies, and I'm no photographer to understand the technology behind it. And I do think they also had every single, there were only something like 11 Technicolor cameras in existence at the time, and this movie had every single one of them. So what they did was they put a lot of bright colors into every single scene. And so that's set pieces, that's costumes. And the minute that you see Errol Flynn walk onto that screen and he's head to toe with his jaunty cap with the feather in it and the bright green and the green tights, that's the Robin Hood that you picture. And there's a reason everybody today can still call up their mind's eye image of Robin Hood, and it's that. It's the person dressed all in green with the giant longbow. So it's just a great introduction to that character. The way the movie kind of plays out are sort of vignettes where they kind of hop from adventure to adventure. So the introduction's not a lot of stuff happening out in that, not even a lot of exposition. It looks great though, and it sort of explodes onto the screen.
Yeah, absolutely. Allison, what's a favorite scene of yours?
Oh gosh. I think, that incredible staircase, is used to such great effect multiple times. You know, they use it for Marion, like, you know, sneaking around and they just see the like hem of her dress around the, it's not really a corner 'cause it's round, but just out of view, you know, and you get that incredible, like, shadow play moment when they're having the Sir Guy and Robin Hood big final sword fight. I like stopped the movie and like made my husband come over and watch that. I was like, look at how cool this is. I think for being like just a big empty gray cavernous space, they really used it to such amazing effect, and they built some really, really cool scenes in that space.
Yeah, what gets me during like that, especially that last sword fight, is they're not just fencing; they're trying to kill each other. Because normally, sometimes in those swashbuckler movies, it's just like, oh, we're just trying to hit each other's sword, you know. But no, these guys are going all in. But yeah, I love the shadow play too. I think that's one of the, to get that lighting effect was just amazing. And I think what I read that they did was they had Rathbone and Flynn, and then they had a set of stunt doubles so that they could do the shadows, and then one would go off screen, and then Rathbone and Flynn could come back in the shot or something like that. But yeah, it works. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting is all the sword fights, there's so much action going on. It almost looks like they've sped up the film sometimes. It's all going so fast. But I think it's just because there's so much energy going on.
I noticed that little bit in the Friar Tuck scene where he falls into the water and they have a sword fight there. And it does feel very quick. And both actors are really just using one arm. It's an amazing bit of stage fighting, I guess you should call.
And when he gives him the piggyback ride across the
he's spanking him with the sword. He's like, come on.
I love the archery contest, the where they set the trap for Robin, because I think it's staged so well, because everybody, you know, it's, there's so much subtext going on, because I think, because Marion starts to realize what's going on, and Robin knows they know who he is and everything, but it's just
from the beginning, he knows they know who he is.
But it's just done so well, and it's shot so well, and you know, just from the close-ups and everything, there's so much suspense, because you know that everybody has their agenda during this, and of course, you know, Robin ends up getting, you know, caught during that. But it's it's really a great scene.
And one of the great like all-time how'd they do it special effects with splitting the arrow.
Oh, I know.
They like recreated it on Mythbusters.
If I recall, they couldn't get it exactly right, right?
Not with a cedar. They couldn't do it with a solid arrow. Yeah. They had to do it with a bamboo arrow, because the hollow arrow would split perfectly like that. When they, I'm a real geek for, I loved Mythbusters so much. When they had the regular arrows, it would go like a third of it. You know, it just didn't aesthetically, it didn't do the same thing. But yes, possible. They just had to use a specialized, you know, special made arrow to do it.
But in 1938, to think of that and to be able to put that film, it's quite an achievement.
Yeah, somebody spent a lot of time figuring that out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It pays off. It looks awesome. It still looks incredible.
Eric, what's another favorite scene of yours?
Well, we touched on it a little bit. I love the whole sequence where the Merry Men ambush the party that's moving the gold, and they don't string them up, they don't kill them, they invite them back for, as you said, Brandon, a barbecue. And it really goes to show you why people are following the character of Robin of Locksley. It goes to show you where his heart is. And I love the turn where he's taking Marion around and shows her the people in the hospital that don't have food or have had family killed. And she immediately knows, I've been wrong. I need to start listening and understanding the world, the larger world around me. She gets responsibility from that. And it gives a little bit of weight to an otherwise just jovial adventure movie. And I think it's a great choice.
Yeah. I mean, you think about 38 coming out of the Great Depression. And you know, we're still a couple of years removed from World War II, but the Depression was still on everybody's minds.
And we're removed from it, but Hitler's in Europe.
Oh, Hitler's in Europe. Yeah. Yeah. We were still a little isolated from it, but
actually the composer.
Yeah. I was going to get to the
kind of the only reason that he's composing this is because he can't go back to Vienna.
He literally was on the last train out.
Yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah, so, yeah, and you're right. And actually, that's something I was going to say, that I viewed that whole sequence very differently this time.
Yes,
you know, I think movies speak to you in different ways depending on what's going on. But yeah, I thought, you know, this, you know, we chose it because it's a great, you know, summer escapist movie. But yeah, there is weight to it, and there really is a message about, you know, learning that you can be wrong about something, and also, you know, just taking care of your fellow man and making sure that, you know, to me, what stands out, I think the great turning point is when he tries to prove to Marion what their goals are, and he says, hey man, what do you think? You know, should we keep all this for ourselves? And immediately the hesitation, they said, no, it's King Richard's money, you know, no, let's give the, you know, and, you know, I think that's another great message. So, you know, that they really packed a message in there that, you know, the world needed to hear then. And I think it needs to hear now.
Olivia de Havilland gets a great speech before Marion is arrested and imprisoned, she gets this impassioned speech about, you know, the injustice of how they're treating these people who, at the end of the day, are no different from them. And like you were saying, movies speak to you differently depending on the time period that you're in, and that with everything going on in the world right now, and especially in the United States right now, that absolutely rang true.
And I love that the last part of that too is the speech. Robin Hood jumps up on a rock and sort of delivers this speech about what their beliefs are. And it's simple, and it's, you know, it's basically, steal from the rich and give to the poor, but treat everybody how you want to be treated. I mean, it's just a great message for.
And even in the final scene, you know, when King Richard finally takes the throne again, and, you know, he's basically just saying, make sure that the Saxons are treated as all Englishmen, you know, and that's really what everyone just wanted. They wanted to be treated equally. Yeah. I love that scene where they've captured King Richard and they don't know who he is, and he's going along with the charade for a little while. The actor who plays King Richard, he doesn't get a whole lot to do, but he's very likable. Ian Hunter is his name, but yeah, he really gives off the impression that this is a benevolent ruler. You'd like to even though we aren't fans of kings or dictators, but still.
A benevolent one.
Yeah, a benevolent one.
I tell my students in the classroom that it's not a democracy. It's a dictatorship. I'm the dictator. I'm a benevolent dictator. Yeah. But I make the rules.
The other thing about this movie to me is just the way certain things are shot. Like, I love, like when Robin and Will are escaping from the castle for the first time after he's, you know, crashed the dinner party or whatever, those day for night shots that they do, where you can tell they shot them in like afternoon or whatever, but they've made it so I mean, it's beautiful, you know, where they're riding through the, they're riding through sort of the California woodlands, but it's still beautiful. But also it takes you out of it when they get the close-ups of them, cause they're in front of a green screen, but you overlook those things. But yeah, just the whole use of color and from the costumes and the sets and everything, they really took advantage of this movie being done in Technicolor to make every scene pop in some way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that I noticed this watch through too, though, is you can draw some parallels between this movie and Game of Thrones. So I don't know if you're a fan of that television show at all. The way the nobles speak and sort of how they organize and the feasts, those are straight out, the Game of Thrones novels. Uh-huh. Or the television show draw those directly from this. The way the nobles are gathered at these tables and are just peeling meat off the bone. That's exactly how they do it on that show. So it's pretty amazing that a show that was produced in the late 2010s is going all the way back to 1938 and catching its influences from there. But it's definitely there.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Any other memorable scenes before we move on?
So I don't know when you want to get to it, but throughout the movie, the score is incredible.
Yeah. Yes, let's move on to that. Amazing. I have a lot of things to say about the score.
Why don't you go ahead, Alex?
Go ahead.
Okay, so our incredible score is very reminiscent of the romantic tone poems. So it's using a lot of uses a lot of chromatic movement, and also kind of I'm going to get music nerd on you here. It's going to get Wagnerian influence with leitmotif, which if that sounds like gibberish to anyone listening, what I'm talking about there is we understand them now because they're just a part of how we experience films. And what it is, you have like a romantic theme that comes up every time so-and-so comes onto the screen. It was not a thing until Wagner really popularized it. And it's, we call them motifs or motives. And it is that a melody or a theme that follows a character throughout, and you get variations on that character theme or a love theme or something like that throughout the entirety of the movie. And this movie does it so incredibly well. You don't even not necessarily notice it right away, because he layers things so well that it's kind of sneaks in on you. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, hang on, I remember this from before. Mm-hmm. And it's a love theme, or it's incredibly well done. It's gorgeous, gorgeous scoring, full orchestration, opera without music, without words, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the reasons Warner Brothers decided to do Robin Hood was there was a popular operetta of Robin Hood, and they originally had wanted to maybe do it as an operetta and borrow Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald from MGM, who were opera stars, and that sort of went by the wayside. But they decided to get somebody of the stature of Eric Wolfgang Korngold to do the score. And mentioned before, Eric, you know, he really said, you know, I don't score action movies. I do drama, I do whatever. But yeah, this is an unforgettable score. I hear those first little strains and I know it's Robin Hood when I hear it. And you can really sense where John Williams was inspired from Korngold. And Jerry Goldsmith was inspired from Korngold. And a lot
I
of
think
those
he kind of set the standard for what swashbuckling sounds like.
And it's interesting. Korngold did another score a couple years later for a movie called King's Row, which is probably the only good movie Ronald Reagan ever made. it's got some good people in it. But if you listen to it, it sounds very similar to Star Wars. It's got a little bit, and it's not science fiction at all, but it's very orchestral, and you can tell where John Williams took some of that inspiration.
Mm. Oh, yeah. They're speaking the same musical language. Yeah. There's a lot of similarity in Williams' compositional style to what Korngold did here.
Yeah. Yeah. And then aside from Korngold, you know, there's just so many great people associated with this movie. This movie has two directors, William Keighley, who was a contract Warner director, started. But unfortunately, it just didn't have the scope and the pacing that they wanted, and it wasn't moving fast enough. So William Keighley was assigned to another movie, and they hired Michael Curtiz, who, if you don't know the name Michael Curtiz, you certainly know the movies he's associated with. This is the man who directed Casablanca, who directed Yankee Doodle Dandy, Captain Blood, Mildred Pierce, White Christmas. And I think one of the reasons why we don't necessarily know his name is he never puts like his personal stamp on it, like Hitchcock would or Scorsese would or something like that. He bleeds into the material and he lets the material do his talking for him. But I think he definitely deserves to be in the, you know, rankings as one of the all time great directors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when the argument comes up as it certainly did in 2019 of directors saying that superhero movies aren't really good for Hollywood or aren't really good movies, this was one of the first superhero movies. I mean, this is a mythological type entity. And that's all those comic book characters are. They're just retellings of myths and what those movies are. And this is the way you do it. And you let the visuals, the sound, and these athletic actors do their things. And you do it well, and you come out with a great movie like The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, Yeah, and like I said, I think it's credit to him. Like I said, it feels like a modern movie because he doesn't let it stop for one second. It keeps moving, and everybody just seems – I think he brought out the naturalness in a lot of actors. Like, nothing seems – it doesn't seem stagey like some movies may feel. Yeah, so as we kind of get to where – We wrap this up a little bit. It's amazing. As I said before, Errol Flynn films weren't considered prestigious by Warner Brothers, but very well-reviewed film actually made $4 million in revenue, and that's 1938, and then was nominated for four Oscars and actually won three. It won art direction, editing, and, of course, the score. And then it actually got nominated for Best Picture. So that's pretty good for an Errol Flynn film, but
for just an adventure movie, yeah.
So it really, and it's interesting because for the Academy to have honored it just with a nomination during that time is big. You know, we don't see many popcorn movies. Was this would probably have been considered, you know, honored by the Academy anymore. And I wish we saw more of sort of the vast scope of everything than what we have gotten in the last couple of decades.
Yeah. I think it was rightfully so. This is a good movie. You can't point to a thing of it and say that this was wrong with this movie. Mm-hmm. And you can certainly do that with a lot of other Best Picture nominees throughout the years. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels like, even though it probably tops a lot of people's lists of good or great movies, it feels like it's a little bit underappreciated, especially now that we're this far removed from it. Mm-hmm. It does feel like it should be a movie that people should revisit every once in a while to see what an adventure movie should look like.
I think probably also because this was 1938 and of course the next year, 39 was so huge and so many classics came out that year.
Right.
I'm sure it's certain. And Errol Flynn was still, you know, Errol Flynn would still make successful movies from there. So it's probably just sort of said, well, it's just another Errol Flynn movie. And it was kind of more, people look more at his body of work than the individual movies. But I think this is sort of the jewel in that body of work. It's a beautiful looking movie. It's a beautiful sounding movie. And it's wonderfully acted. I mean, there's some really great performances in a movie that you wouldn't think about great performances coming from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as we kind of wrap up here, Allison, final thoughts on The Adventures of Robin Hood.
I can't believe I hadn't actually watched this movie through until now. It's delightful. I will watch it again. I have a 2-year-old who I bet would enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that it will go into the rotation for me. So fun.
Great. Awesome. Yeah. Eric?
Yeah, it's one that everybody should add to their list of movies that should be seen. This is the one that all the others point to and say, okay, how do we do it as good as or if not better than that? And it influenced the Daffy Duck, Porky Pig cartoon. Yep. That Errol Flynn actually appeared in. You know, they took a cut from this film and stuck it into that old Looney Tunes cartoon where they were doing Robin Hood. So to me, that's the ultimate testament to the greatness of this film.
I mean, and Men in Tights. You get a Mel Brooks movie that's like a straight-up parody.
Exactly. And it's like, oh my gosh, like shots for some
it's
of those.
It's so good. Like, having grown up with Men in Tights and not actually seen this all the way through, watching it, I was like, wow, okay, Mel Brooks did a good job.
Yeah, and I guarantee you a lot of people are that way who've seen that movie and not this one. Go check this one out.
Yeah, right. Seriously. If you like Men in Tights, you're going to enjoy this.
Yeah, and another thing, and I forgot to mention this earlier, but Entangled, the character of Flynn Rider is an homage to Errol Flynn. So his legacy and the legacy of this movie still goes on.
The phrase "in like Flynn" was was him too. I mean, if you're going to go see an Errol Flynn movie, I agree. I think this should be the one that you go check out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a fun movie, and especially as we mentioned before, in the time that we're living in, it's a good escapist movie, but you're going to be hit with a message that you didn't think you would, and it's probably a message you need to hear.
Surprise, so, morality.
Yeah. So a little bit of everything. So I'm glad that this is a movie we were finally able to get to and pay the correct homage that it deserves. But hopefully this summer, as we've mentioned before, we're going to try and do some summary type movies down the pike. It's funny, Eric and I, after the last podcast, we actually sort of made up a list of all the classics we can do, and I think it's about 9 pages
worth. We got a lot of work to do, Brandon.
We got a lot of work to do.
A lot of movies to watch.
But you know what? That's good. I originally thought, I said, you know, we've kind of talked about a lot of the big ones. Are we maybe winding down? But nope.
Not by a long shot.
We're just starting. So, and you know what? That's good news, because I love talking movies. So let's keep on doing it. Once again, like I said, we'll be bringing out more classics for you throughout the summer. Some fun movies, and then we'll head into the fall with a little more serious fare maybe. So just sort of keeping the variety going. So once again, you can find all of our content on our NPR website. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, any of the social media platforms, and just keep listening, because we love doing this. So once again, for the Front Row Network, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Eric Flick.
And I'm Allison Means.
And we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.